Boker Tov, everybody. Really a pleasure to see everybody as we start part four of our wonderful series on Megillat Esther and all its readers. I want to thank the Shimon and Sur families who are sponsoring this morning's or afternoon shiur in observance of the Yortzeit today, Bo Bayom, the 28th of Adar Aleph, for their father, grandfather, and great father, Yosef Mordechai Ben Fega Be Eliezer. He taught the family love of Torah, Israel, life, and nature, where we merit long life and good health and peace, internally and external peace. Thank you very much. Bakasha, Dr. Kohler.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. So we are, as Kelvin just said, part four. And what we're going to be doing today is getting into the world of Chazal. So I'll just sketch out quickly what we're going to do in the three sessions we have left. We're going to spend some time on Chazal today and into next week. And then the last session and a half or so, we'll deal with some modern takes on the Book of Esther, which also I think are very attuned to some of the problems that could arise from reading it and some of the ways we sketched out at the beginning. So we'll see how the state of Israel has affected that. And religious ideologies have affected the way people have read the Book of Esther. So those will be the last couple of sessions. But today, the world of Chazal. So I hope, Rabbi Kelman, were the sources posted on the website?
They are, and I'm on my way to posting them on the chat book. That's what I was doing while you were telling what you're doing for the next couple weeks. They'll be in the chat box in a minute.
Okay, thank you so much. So this is going to be there's a lot of sources here. We're not going to work carefully through all of them, but I do want to put a lot there, and we'll see how much time we have time for to work through in a lot of detail, and some we'll just be able to touch on. The first source that I put on the sheet is actually not a rabbinic source. It's just a point made by Professor Moshe Halbertal in a book he wrote back in the 90s, thank you, Rabbi Kelman, called People of the Book. And he's actually not talking about Esther in the comment that he makes here, but he is talking about the process of interpretation that goes on once a book is considered to be biblical. And we have intentionally glossed over the question of how exactly Esther became a biblical book. Last week, when we were discussing the Greek book of Esther and the book of Judith and the Dead Sea Scrolls, it was clear that the book of Esther was not a quote-unquote biblical book. In other words, people could still change it, edit it, ignore it, reject it, do all sorts of things, which, of course, are not possible with a book that's already considered to be part of Kitvei HaKodesh. But Halbertal makes the following point. When a book was introduced into the body of scriptures, however, it was required to give up its unique and heretical message. The moment it became part of the scriptural canon, the exegete was obligated to make it consistent with the rest of the scriptures. The new reading means that the original meaning will be lost. Now, he's not talking about Esther. He's actually talking about Shir HaShirim, starting from a particular assumption about the history of how Shir HaShirim became a biblical book that I'm not going to spend more time on now. And I'm not even so interested in defending the details of the way he formulated it, but I do think the overall point is a very important point. And that's that Chazal, despite one hint to the contrary, essentially Chazal, when they get Tanakh, they get Tanakh. There are 24 books in the Kitvei HaKodesh and in the Hebrew, what we call the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible. There are, as you know, wasn't true then, but we now know there are 929 Prakim. It wasn't true then because, of course, Prakim are a later invention, the actual division into chapters. But all those chapters were there. So Chazal are not looking at a book and saying, well, I don't know, is this a good book? Is it a bad book? Should we edit it? Should we change it? Should we reject it? Of course, there are a couple of passages here and there about certain books that Bikshu Lignoz, that there was a suggestion to maybe get rid of a certain book or a certain section of a book because some things were just considered too problematic. It said about Yechezkel, it said about Kohelet. So this shouldn't be taken as an oversimplifying statement that no one was struggling anymore. On the contrary, I think the point here, and the point that I take from Halbertal's formulation, is that you do have to struggle. It's just that your struggle is within constraints. So you're no longer free to say, Esther is not a good book, therefore it won't be part of Ketuvei HaKodesh. If you think Esther is a problematic book, you're starting from the assumption that even though it looks to me like a problematic book, it is part of Ketuvei HaKodesh, and so I have to figure out why I'm wrong in thinking it's problematic. Let me look more carefully. Let me interpret it more. Let me see if I can see things in it that I didn't see the first time or the first 10 times that I went through it. Since it's part of Tanakh, since it's written Baruch HaKodesh, it's part of Ketuvei HaKodesh, clearly it's not a problematic book. So now I have to figure out why it's not a problematic book. I can't just say like, oh, well, you know, this is a challenge and move on. I have to solve that problem. I have to figure out what to do about that. So what we're going to see is a number of different interrelated aspects of how Chazal thought about the Book of Esther. Some of the sources we'll see just clue us in that Chazal were acutely aware of some of the challenges of Esther. And some of them will show us some of the ways in which Chazal read Esther to either minimize or even flip some of the challenges on their heads. Okay, so let's get into this. So the first, so I can't remember, I'm sorry, who a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, mentioned this this point. I know that they had moved to the top left of my screen, but that's only because they had raised their hand. So that's not a useful thing to remember. But one of the most really profound points that Chazal make is made in essentially a throwaway line in the Gemara in Chulin. Gemara in Chulin on Kuf Lamed Tet Amud Bet says, Esther min ha-Torah minayin, v'anochi haster astir panai b'yomahu. So quoting a pasuk, and you know from Dvarim Lamed Aleph, right before Ha'azinu, the Gemara asks, where is a hint to Esther from the Torah? And it quotes the pasuk, Anochi haster astir panai b'yomahu. Now, I said this is profound, but it seems kind of trivial at first glance. Right? I mean, it seems like it's wordplay. Like, where do we have a hint for Esther from the Torah? Well, there is this pasuk in Dvarim Lamed Aleph, Anochi haster astir. So it sounds like, oh, I have a hint to Esther from the Torah in this pasuk that uses the words haster and astir. But of course, that really would just be wordplay, and not that Chazal never engage in wordplay, but in this case, there's clearly something much more profound going on. They're asking, Esther min haTorah minayin, in other words, where does the Torah ever license a story like Esther? Does the Torah ever tell us that there will be a story like Esther? Esther, you remember, is so vastly different from what the Torah tells, for example. I mean, who's the main character in the Torah?
Moshe.
God,
for sure. You know, yes, God disappears, you know, a parak here, a parak there, but like, basically, this is a story of God. So, of course, at the beginning, it's entirely a story of God, then it's a story of God's relationship with people and God's relationship with a nation, but this is a book where God is front and center the entire time. I mean, literally the first character introduced and has accompanied the story the entire time. Now, given that, I look at the other books and I say, does the Torah ever even license, even hint at there being a story without God? Can there be Esther min haTorah? Like, does that make any sense? The Torah is all about God. God is intimately involved minute to minute, day to day in the Torah story. Right? So there's the big things like Yetziat Mitzrayim, Kriyat Yamsuf, Matan Torah. But then there's just, he's talking to people all the time, you know, telling people what to do, getting korban. Like, he's just constantly there. So Esther min haTorah minayin is not, you know, where do I find a hint for Esther's name from the Torah? It's, can there be anything in the Torah that's ever clued us in that there will be a story like Esther? Such a vastly different theological world. And the answer, which is so brilliant because it works on these two different levels, is not just a pun. It's, yes, it's there in Dvarim. V'anochi haster astir panai b'yom ahu. The Torah tells us that there will one day be a time that God's face will be hidden. So amazing that that actually is said in words that sound a lot like Esther's name. But don't get distracted by the pun. The pun is just the first surface level of this answer to the question of Esther min haTorah minayin. The real point is the Torah has actually told us in advance that there will be a story like the Book of Esther. But let's also make clear that that's not a simple statement of fact, because it's not obvious in Megillat Esther that God's face is hidden. There are alternatives. God's face may be simply absent. God might not be involved at all. So in saying that the remez la Esther min haTorah is from the pasuk Vanochi haster astir panai bayom ahu, what the Chazal are really saying is not just here's the link, but here's how you have to read Esther. Right? This is the clue. The only way to read Esther, the Torah has given us one and only one way of reading Esther. The way to read Esther is as hester panim. It's a story where God is absolutely present, but hidden. God's face is covered, is concealed, but not, chas v'shalom, absent entirely. So Chazal have actually done a huge amount of interpretive work in this one throwaway line. I'm not going to claim that every line of Gemara works on three different levels and actually contains worlds of interpretation. But it is, I think, humbling and fascinating and also really challenging to realize that sometimes what Chazal is doing, like, just is not on the surface. If we had written the same thing, the same interpretive thing, it would have been like a 5-page essay. It would have said, like, you know, here's the question, here's the big challenge, where I'm going to look for precedent, I find it over here, this is the theological point at the end of the Dvarim, and that then tells me how to read Esther. Chazal just speak a very different language. They write in a very different genre. And they write sometimes in, telegraphically, so it's one line, but that one line is actually meant to convey a lot of depth of interpretation and thought. So that one line is really important for both showing us the anxiety that they feel, Esther min haTorah minayin, like, is this okay? Do we have anything from the Torah that tells us it's okay? And then the answer, it says it is okay, because here's how we're going to read it. We're not going to read it as the absence of God. We're going to read it as the concealment of God. And that is licensed there in Dvarim Lamed Aleph. Okay, Yehudi. You're muted, though. Yehudi, you're still muted.
All right, we can wait.
Okay, all right now. The last 10 chapters of Sefer Bereishis, starting with chapter 40, going down to that 50, don't have Shem Hashem once, except for Lishuatcha Kiviti Hashem, which is part of a poem and has nothing to do with the narrative. In other words, you really get the feeling that Megillat Esther is modeled to some extent on Sipur Yosef, not just by that, but by plenty of other, phrases that both stories have in common. And that would be a good precedent for writing a story without Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei's name. Granted, they have Elohim, but a lot of times in that story, it means the gods. It does not mean specifically Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. When Pharaoh says, Acharei Hodia Elohim et Kol Zot, that's obviously Pharaoh doesn't believe in Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. He believes in the gods. That's all he means by that statement.
That's a great point. That's one.
And point two is Shir Hashem doesn't have Shem Hashem either. Somehow nobody ever got excited about that. I mean, as a practical matter, the only even hint to it is Shahavet Yah, which we now know is Shahavet Kedol Ma'od, and has nothing to do with Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, like Merchav Yah or Matil Yah, words of that nature.
All right, so very, very briefly, the first one's obviously actually directly relevant, and I fully agree with you. So we have not spent any time on the question of how Megillat Esther draws on the story of Yosef, but you're absolutely right. That is central to understanding Esther. And I think you're absolutely right. Had we spent time on those connections, I would have also mentioned that in the context of the absence of God. There's Paraklam, if we were reading the Torah as a story of God, which I think it is, we would have gotten to Paraklam and Zion, Mechirat Yosef, and realized that this is the first story that takes place without God. So you're right, that continues when Yosef is in Mitzrayim, but Paraklam and Zion has no God whatsoever. Now, later on, Yosef says, but that really was God, right? And that's something that opens up interpretive possibilities for Esther. So, okay, maybe this is another story where there's no God, but later on we're supposed to come along and say, now I understand, really it was God. But you're absolutely right. And the question of Galut seems important, right? Yosef's now in Mitzrayim. Maybe God doesn't appear to him there. But I'll leave that for you all to consider and think about and add your own insights. As for Shir HaShirim, right, I don't think that no one's ever gotten excited about it, but you're certainly right. Of course, what's made it less of an issue is that the same basic interpretive move, well, if you see the whole thing as a metaphor for the relationship between God and Israel, or like the Rambam has it, God and the human soul, then of course God's name's not mentioned. The whole thing is a metaphor about God. So I don't have to worry about God's name. Literally every line is about God. But you're absolutely right. And I think some of the similar questions arise. And some people have even suggested that the opinion that Shir HaShirim is not Mitameh Et HaYadayim, in other words, not part of Kitvei HaKodesh, is exactly because it doesn't have God's name in it. But I'll have to put that aside for when Rabbi Kelman invites me back for, I don't know, Pesach or something. Anyway, okay, not for now. Sima. No? I saw you put it in the chat. Was that the...
Okay. Yeah, that was my question.
Because I saw you had 100 students, so I thought you might not respond to direct questions.
But we did. Okay. Let's go on now. Okay. Now, some people said some important things in the chat that I think are really worth thinking about, whether all the Min HaTorah Minayins are to be read in similar ways. Really good question. I have some thoughts on some of the other ones, but not as they don't work out as well. So I will leave them for you to consider, as I'll continue thinking about them also. Let's go to the next source on the sheet, though. This we have from, I forgot to write where it's from. It's from the Gemara in Megillah. We got a really interesting story, a little anecdote. It's said in the name of Rav and Rav Chanina and Rav Yochanan and Rav Chaviva, all taught. Shalcha lehem Esther lachachamim, kitvuni ledorot. So Esther wrote to the sages and said, write me down for generations. And I was, write me down forever. Shalchula, halo katavti lecha shalishim. Shalishim velo ribeim. They said, we can't. Unfortunately, we have no room for you in the Tanakh. We can't canonize you. Because here's the thing. Your story is essentially a story of the Jewish people fighting against Amalek. And we have a pasuk, taken totally out of context, that says we're only allowed to have three stories of the Jewish people fighting against Amalek. And we already have three. So we have no room for you. Ad shematzulo mikra katuv batorah, ktov zot zikaron basefer. Until they said, actually, the story of Amalek itself, back in Shmot Yud Zayin, tells us that we do have to write another episode of the war against Amalek. K'tov zot, masha katuv kan of Mishneh Torah. So we have to have a story first in Shmot, and then again in Dvarim, as of course Parshat Zachor. Zikaron, masha katuv banivim, the story of Shaul fighting against Agag and Amalek. And then Basefer, masha katuv bamegillah. Now, there's again a couple of really important things going on here in what seems like just a weird story. One is that fundamentally this assumes that the story of the Megillah is basically just another iteration of the war between Bnei Israel and Amalek. That is never explicit in Megillat Esther. And even if we assume that Haman HaGagi is meant to evoke Amalek, which I think is reasonable and probably right, even if so, it's hard to reduce Esther to just another story of the Jews fighting Amalek. But okay, that's the first move. First move is, this is another story of Bnei Israel fighting Amalek. Second of all, again, we see the same anxiety. Like, do we have room for Esther in Tanakh? Is there any, like, can this story fit into Tanakh? They said, we can't. We have no more room for you. Like, we have a story, we're done. We can't have another story like this until they found a license for it. And again, the license for it has to come from the Torah itself. Right, so I think this is really fascinating. You know, there's no room for Esther in Tanakh unless the Torah already clued us in that there's going to be a story like Esther in Tanakh. In this case, it's the story of Amalek. Now, Amalek is particularly interesting because, again, it is plausibly part of it. Where's our source for fighting against Amalek? So of course we're going to read it in just a couple of weeks. So we have Parshat Zachor. And what does Parshat Zachor essentially say? So we have, I'm sure you remember it because you hear it all the time. So Zachor, the Shara Zalach Amalek, but Derech was Yechtan of Mitzrayim, Shekar Chava Derech, Vaizaniv B'chal Kona Chashim Nachorecha, Vatayev Vagiev, Lo Yerah Lehim. Now listen carefully. V'haya b'haniach Hashem Elokecha lecha mikol oyvecha misaviv ba'aret asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha nachala l'rishta timcheh zecher Amalek mitachar hashamayim lo tishkach. So absolutely explicit. Where is the mitzvah of Mechiyat Amalek supposed to take place?
In Israel.
In Israel. You're going to get to Israel. After you finish dealing with the nations around you and God gives you rest, right? Haniyacha. Then go fight against Amalek. So Shaul, okay, that makes good sense, right? I mean, that's sort of exactly the right timing. Like they finally settled down. They have a king. We're here. We've made it. Now it's time to go fight against Amalek. Failed. Esther is exactly the wrong time to fight against Amalek, right? I mean, this is outside the land of Israel. This is the sort of the opposite of what it says there in Parshat Zachor. Now you're scattered among the nations. Mefuzar mefurad ben ha'amim. Now is not the time to go timchad zechar Amalek. And yet, I think clues us into another thing that Chazal are going to do that we're going to see in more explicitly coming up, which is that Esther was necessary in order to pave the way for a return to Eretz Yisrael. So it may well be that what Chazal is saying is as follows. Look, you were supposed to get rid of Amalek in the days of Shaul. Unfortunately, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, didn't happen. Shaul failed, right? His fault, not his fault, doesn't matter right now. It didn't happen. Agag survived and apparently Amalek survived. And now we have a problem because now Amalek is no longer just a nation in the south of Israel, wherever they were used to hang out. If you have Haman HaAgagi off in Shushan HaBirah, that means that Amalek is all over the world, just like the Jews are all over the world. So how are you ever going to be Mochei Tzecher Amalek at this point? How is that going to work? Well, there's only one answer. The answer is you have to go chase down Amalek wherever they may be. And what's that going to allow? It's going to allow you to then return to Israel and return to Israel without Amalek. You can't do it in Israel anymore. And so a war like Esther wages off throughout the 127 provinces is now necessary to get rid of Amalek, which is scattered through the nations, scattered through the world. I think that's right, but I'm not going to belabor the point now. The most important points here are, again, that the story is seen primarily as a war against Amalek, and it's only allowed in Tanakh because it's licensed by earlier parts of Tanakh to say, yes, we're going to need one last war against Amalek. It's not enough to have the war that Yehoshua fights in Shemot Yud Zayin. It's not enough to have Parshat Zachor in Dvarim Kafei. It's not enough to have the war of Shaul against Agag. The Torah tells us that there's going to be one more Basefer, one more story of a book of the war against Amalek. And so here, this is the role that Esther is going to play. So again, we see Chazal really struggling. Like, we don't get this with other books, right? That they're like, well, I don't know. Is there a place for Divrei Yamim in Tanakh? Even though it's like super boring. Better to ask that question. We don't have the same anxiety about, like, is there a place for Sefer Mishlei in Tanakh? Sefer Mishlei, it's a book of wisdom. Shlomo wrote it. It's good, right? Maybe we interpret it, but we don't worry about whether or not it belongs in Tanakh. But with Esther, we see over and over Chazal asking, does it even belong here? Like, you know, Esther says, Kitvunu Dorot, and Chazal say, sorry, we can't anymore. Like, there's just no room for you in Tanakh until they find license for Esther from the Torah. Yudi, maybe if you either hold off for a few minutes, or if you want to put it in the chat, we'll get to it in a few minutes, whichever one you prefer. But
I wouldn't fall because okay. He's not going to look in the chat any sooner either.
Okay. Now, Chazal also put into the mouths of some of the characters the same anxiety, the sense that something's different about this book. I love this line. So this is in Midrash. We have actually open this up just to show you very quickly. Let me just share my screen for a second. So we have, I should say, as I open this up, we have more Midrashim on Esther than on any other book in Tanakh except for Bereshit. Chazal spent a huge amount of time studying and interpreting Megillat Esther. We have Esther Rabbah, which we've touched on a little bit in past weeks, just drawing on it, talked a little bit about the textual history of it. But we have also things like Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar, but we also have these Midrashic collections. So this was published, you see, by Shlomo Buber. That's Martin Buber's grandfather. Back in the late 19th century, he found a manuscript in Oxford that has what's called first Midrash Abba Gurion. And then the manuscript itself says Panim Acherot. So after Midrash Abba Gurion, the manuscript says, now we got to Midrash Panim Acherot. It actually says Panim Acherot in the manuscript. Buber thought that was a grammatical problem, so he changed it to Panim Acherim. But there's Panim Acherim Acherot 1, and then Panim Acherot 2. And then there's even more Midrashim in this collection. And they start from the beginning. So you see Panim Acherot 2, Vayibim Achashverosh, Zesh Amar Katuv, and we'll actually look at this Midrash together in a little bit. We just have a lot of different Midrashic collections to study and draw from in looking at how Chazal interpreted Esther. In addition to all of those Midrashim, which are like scattered all throughout different printings and different books, we also have the one and only Babylonian Midrash on a book of Tanakh. There's like one other maybe partial exception to that, but for those of you who learned Masechet Megillah recently, so you know that you get to Daf Yud Amud Bet in Masechet Megillah, and suddenly it says, actually starts with some p'tichto, that different Tanaim and Amoraim opened their study of Megillat Esther with a Midrash. And then it becomes a running Midrash on Megillat Esther. It's the only thing we have like that in the Talmud Bavli. All of the Midrashim we have, Bereshit Rabba, Vayikra, all Midrashim from Eretz Israel. There are no Babylonian Midrashim collections, except for this, which is, now people call the Babylonian Esther Midrash, but it's really just the last 6.5 blot or so of the first parak of Masechet Megillah, and it's a running Midrash. So that, I think, is really interesting, both in terms of the quantitative point. In other words, we have just so much Midrash on Esther, but also because you wonder whether there's some particular reason that Babylonian Jews are interested in Esther, as opposed to all the rest of Tanakh, and think like, oh, this is a book we need to interpret. So we'll see soon that this is not ambiguous. The Babylonian Jews were acutely aware of the fact that this is their book. This is a book that takes place in the Eastern diaspora, in Galut Babel, and so is more about them than other books of Tanakh. So I say that both because we're going to see some of those details coming up, and also because you'll see in the sources here that this one is from Midrash Panim Acherot Bet, and you may well be wondering like, what is that and how would I find it? So it is in these collections. If you want the whole, I could ask Rabbi Kalman to post it, but actually on HebrewBooks.org, that whole PDF of Buber's Midrasha collections are there, and you can download it from there as well. So that's all introduction to this one line. Midrash Panim Acherot quotes Mordechai as saying this. He says, God, eini zaz mikan ad she'aseh li HaKadosh Baruch Hu nisim k'shem she'aseh l'rishonim. Mordechai sort of folds his arms in front of the royal gate and says, I am not moving from here until God does for me the same thing they did for Jews of old. I know what God can do. God can split the sea. God can take us out of Egypt. God can do all sorts of cool things. Why am I sitting here fasting and screaming and getting nothing in return? I want a miracle just like God did for the people in times of old. Now, this is not only a question of the character of Mordechai. I think most importantly, what this is Chazal pointing out that those times of old are not there in Megillat Esther. We seem to be in a different world. But that's not just something that, you know, you might say like, oh, that's interesting. I guess we're in a different world. Chazal don't think it's just something to be sanguine about. Like, that's interesting. You know, I guess times change. You know, God no longer gets involved in human affairs the way God used to. That's not the response that Chazal think is appropriate. The response that Chazal think is appropriate is to scream in protest about that. What do you mean we're in a different world? God, you can save us. Then you have a moral obligation to save us. You have a religious obligation to save us. You have a covenantal obligation to save us. You can't just say like, sorry, guys, you know, now we're post-exilic, so you're on your own. Like, that's not how a relationship works. If you used to do things like this, then you have to keep doing things like this. And again, it's not just the claim that I think is really important here. It's the background to the claim. What this starts with is an observation that we don't have miracles in the book of Esther the way we do in other earlier books of Tanakh. And then comes a response to that observation. That's not okay, says Mordechai. I want miracles. I want to live in the old world. All right, so maybe I'll pause there. And Yudi, let's hear from you. And let me open the chat and see what else came
up
there.
Can I ask something?
Sure, absolutely. Sorry, Yudi.
I was wondering why in the whole book of Esther, the name Hadassah is not mentioned. Maybe because this is Megillat HaGalut. This is really, you know, and Hadassah is...
That's great. Fantastic. I think that's exactly right. I don't want to belabor the point right now, but I think that's exactly right. A lot of the book revolves around the question of identity in Galut. And here's someone who we know has both a good Hebrew name and a Persian name. And even though we're told her Hebrew name at the beginning, we never hear her Hebrew name again. Even after she says, you know, I am a Jewish person, doesn't matter. She's still Esther. What we do get, and I'll just leave you with this to think about, is at the end, literally at the very end of Perek Tet, we get her mentioned as Esther Hamalka Bat Avichail. So she's still Esther, still Malka, but for the first time since Perek Bet, we're reminded that her father had a good Hebrew name also. So maybe her identity is, again, complicated at the end. But yeah, it's a really wonderful, wonderful point. Okay. Sorry, I just lost my chat. Where my chat go? Here we go.
Which one to go back? I'm like.
Okay. Yeah, so briefly.
I have a problem with that because there is a place in Ketuvim where Amalek is mentioned, and that's in Divrei Yirmiyahu chapter 4 at the end, where it becomes apparent that in the time of Hizkiyahu, Shebet Shimon put an end to whatever Amalekites were still left living in Eretz Israel by Akuat Sheirit HaPleita Shel Amalek. After that point, it wouldn't make any difference anymore because Mishabas and Kerem Melech Hashor Bilbel Koha Umot, then as Amalekite could apply for conversion to become a Jew and he would be accepted. So why are we still preoccupied? In other words, I've always had a problem with even the whole idea of reading from the Pshat point of view that the major issue of Megillat Esther is Amalek. That to me comes across as just one big drash. You can have a great deal of fun with it. There's no question the rabbis accepted it, but it still doesn't mean that that's what the Pshat of the book is about.
Okay. I'm happy to leave that as a really insightful comment and a problem that we will not pursue now, but yeah, those are both the Devarim main point and the Esther question are really legitimate and substantive points that we just won't be able to pursue right now. But thank you. Okay. Let me put these sources back up. Now, we've danced around this the last couple of weeks. But one thing that absolutely colors the way Chazal read Esther is their sense of the chronology of Esther. And this gets really tricky. And I tried to spend a lot of time just figuring out how they got to what they say and what they mean by what they say. I'm not going to bore you with all of the nitty gritty details here. But let me tell you the upshot of what Chazal do. So the first thing to say, it starts with a question of sources. And then it moves to a question of methodology, and then we get to the question of results. So what I mean by that is as follows. We say, like, you know, without batting an eyelash, that Churban Bayit Rishon was in 586 BCE. Chanukat Bayit Sheni was in 516-15 BCE. And then I can give you dates for, you know, Achashverosh, which I gave, you know, 485, he comes to the throne, and so on. Alexander the Great's in 333. You know, I have a whole timeline, right? I can easily look these things up. That's what Wikipedia is for, but, you know, you didn't even need Wikipedia for these things. Like, it's, this has been known for hundreds of years. But those dates are not derived from within Tanakh. Within Tanakh, we get, of course, relative dates. So we get X number of years from point A to point B, Y number of years from point B to point C. But then put that, well, how many years before Alexander the Great was Bayit Sheni built? No one ever tells us that in Tanakh. So those dates are derived from taking what we have in Tanakh and synchronizing them with what we have from outside of Tanakh, from what we have from earlier times, Assyrian and Babylonian evidence, and then Greek writers like Herodotus, who is a contemporary of Achashverosh's, who tells us, you know, where he lives and how many years he lived and how many years after X, Y, and Z and who his predecessor was and so on and so forth. And we get, using all of that information, we come up with a multidimensional timeline. So this is what's going on in Greece, and this is what's going on in Babylon, this is what's going on in Persia, and this is what's going on in Israel. And then we can start to say, like, well, this is X number of years before that, or putting it in absolute terms, this is X number of years before, quote unquote, zero, right? Which is obviously just a conventional way of thinking, and there was no year zero. But it's helpful to just put things in conversation with each other. So, but part of that assumes that we have, for example, Herodotus. Now, there's a lot of discussion in modern scholarship about how much Greek and Latin stuff Chazal were reading. Right? And there are words and phrases and expressions that, you know, well, gematria is a Greek word and Sanhedrin is a Greek word. So, like, clearly they're influenced to some extent by Greek culture. And that's obviously true. But in a deep sense, they are absolutely insulated from Greek culture. In other words, not in the sense of language, but in the real sense. Like, have they studied Herodotus? Absolutely not. Clearly not. Now, Herodotus is, you know, 500 years, 600 years before the Mishnah. They could have studied Herodotus if they wanted to. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi speaks Greek. He says, you know, it's more important to speak Greek than Aramaic. But that apparently does not mean that he's reading Greek historians about the Persian period. So the first thing I said is about the sources, Chazal are not making use of, and I don't know, it's hard to say whether this is intentional, like we won't read Herodotus and Thucydides, or unintentional. They don't know about Herodotus, I don't know. But whatever the case is, they don't use Greek historians to reconstruct Jewish history. I can say that it would have been helpful, but they don't use them. The second thing is, that maybe as a matter of ideology, maybe just as a matter of fact, everything that they do, therefore, comes from Tanakh. So as they reconstruct Jewish history, it's entirely based on data that they get from Tanakh. Now, Tanakh, you know, when you have something like, say, from Lachim, it's pretty good. You know, you're not going to be able to line it up with the Assyrians, but you can say, you know, Yoash lived X number of years, in his 12th year he did whatever. At the same time, there's a king up in Israel. So you can do a lot of information. But when you think about Tanakh, when you get to Bayit Sheni times, you realize that we have no book like Malachim. Yudi mentioned Divrei Yamim, which gets us to the beginning of Bayit Sheni, but no further, even though it's written later in Bayit Sheni times. And we have no book that's a chronicle of Bayit Sheni history. So suddenly Chazal are dataless. I don't know if that's actual word, but whatever. They don't have a lot of data for the first couple of centuries of Bayit Sheni history. So they sit with Tanakh and they try to extract whatever information they can from Tanakh, but it's very limited. So they realize that there are a number of kings' names, of Persian kings, right? You have a guy named Koresh who's mentioned, you have a guy named Daryavesh who's mentioned, you have a guy named Achashverosh who's mentioned, both in Sefer Ezra and in Megillat Esther. You have a name Artaxasta, also mentioned a couple of different places. But there is actually very little by way of what order to put those kings in. It's easy for us because we already know the framework. We know that it goes Cyrus, then Cambyses, who's never mentioned in Tanakh, then Darius, then Ahasuerus, then Artaxerxes. But that's not explicit in Tanakh. So that first problem is just like, what order do I put these people in? How long did they reign? Well, all I can really say is, what's the biggest number ever given for any one of their reigns? So Chazal, just to take the one that's most directly relevant to Megillat Esther, Chazal say that Ahasuerus ruled for 12 years. In fact, Ahasuerus rules for 20 years. But how do they come to the number 12? It's really straightforward. 12 is the biggest number that we have associated with Ahasuerus. So I know he ruled for 12 years. I don't know he ruled for 13, so I give him 12. Given all of these constraints, Chazal, the biggest issue is, the biggest conclusion is that Chazal conclude that the Persian period lasted 52 years. Almost all of which, or much of which at least, was before the construction of the second Beit HaMikdash. Any modern historian will tell you that the Persian period starts in, 539, when Cyrus takes over the empire, takes over the Babylonia, and goes until Alexander the Great defeats them in 332. So more than 200 years of Persian rule in the area. So this creates a 150-something year gap between Chazal's arithmetic and our own arithmetic about the history. So this, you know, gives rise to things like Chazal saying that Bayit Sheni stood for 420 years, more than Bayit Rishon, which only stood 410 years. But you think, you know, basic arithmetic tells you that actually Bayit Sheni stood for 585 years. Like, they're off by more than a century and a half. It's not good or bad. You know, it's not, they're not maximizing, minimizing. They're just off. In their arithmetic, because we have a lot more data that we can use to actually piece together history than they were making use of. Now, this is not meant to be a criticism. It's really meant as background for the following really important point. So I put this chart up. This chart, I don't know if this chart is useful. It was useful.
You want to make it a little wider? Doc, you want to make it a little wider so people can see it a little better? Thank you.
Yeah, hold on. Let me see if I can make the window bigger. And then I'll try to say what's here. Yeah. So this is useful for me to just try to work out the numbers. So there's really two different things going on here. So this is modern historians. So I'm not going to go over this, but here are the things that we can date and the years BCE that we would give these events. So Nebuchadnezzar, Churban Bayit Sheni, Bayit Rishon, I'm sorry. Other kings who we don't really care that much about right now, although, you know, Evil Merodach shows up at the end of Malachim, and so on. Nabonidus, okay. Now, you see that people like Labashi Marduk, who admittedly ruled for 3 months in the year 556 BCE, according to Chazal, do not exist. Same thing is true with Nabonidus, who does not exist in Chazal's historiography in the sense that Chazal never mention him and don't seem to be aware of his existence. Now, honestly, how would they be aware of his existence? We know about him from Babylonian chronicles. Actually, we now know that he's mentioned in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls also, but that's not helpful for Chazal. So he rules for 17 years. He's the last king of Babylon, but how would Chazal have known of his existence? So those 17 years are essentially wiped off the map in Chazal's timeline. On the other hand, what that opens up is the conclusion that Belshazzar and Daryavesh HaMadi, who we'll put aside, and then Koresh and Ahasuerus, all, depending on where you start the clock, all rule before the construction of the second Beit HaMikdash. All these people rule, according to Chazal, because we've gotten rid of a number of the kings who actually took a lot of that time up, it turns out that according to Chazal's timeline, Belshazzar and Dayavish and Koresh, and then Cambyses and Darius first don't exist, and Ahasuerus all rule before the Beit HaMikdash is constructed. So this is historically inaccurate, but ideologically incredibly significant. Because that's not just an arithmetic issue. What it means is that when you're reading Esther, you're not reading what's going on at the same time that Jews in Yerushalayim are building and dedicating and operating the Beit HaMikdash. You're actually reading the prelude to the construction of the Mikdash. Now, as this is taking place, according to Chazal, in the interlude between Batei Mikdash, and that opens the possibility that actually Megillat Esther is a prologue. It's going to pave the way for the future Binyan Beit HaMikdash and Chanukat Beit HaMikdash. So as opposed to seeing this as something that's happening like alongside the community in Yerushalayim, they're seeing it as something that paves the way for their return to Yerushalayim. The most explicit claim of this sort is the claim that Esther's son was the Daryavish under whom the Beit HaMikdash was built. Now, Chagai tells us that the Beit HaMikdash was dedicated in the second year of Daryavish, but again, never tells us whether Daryavish is before or after Achashverosh. So a modern historian really doesn't have a lot of trouble with that. Here's Darius, right? It says Darius right before Xerxes. That's straightforward. But for Chazal, actually Esther and Achashverosh have a son, never mentioned in the Megillah, obviously. That son is Darius. He becomes the king, and it's under him that the Beit HaMikdash is constructed. So that's not, again, here's the key point. That's not just a question of chronology and therefore, like, you know, a timeline that you might have someone memorize that's important to know Jewish history. The point is that this chronology is ideologically very significant. Because, of course, if Esther's son allows for the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, that means the Megillat Esther is not, chas v'shalom, subversive or oppositional to the community in Yerushalayim. On the contrary, it's a necessary antecedent to the community in Yerushalayim. What happened in Shushan HaBirah was necessary in order to allow the sequel, which is the construction of the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. So when you see the parallels between Shushan HaBirah and Yerushalayim that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that's not because this is seen as a replacement for Yerushalayim. On the contrary, it's a tragedy that this is what's happening in Shushan right now, like the center of powers in Shushan. But don't worry, that's just this generation. Next generation, that's going to return with the Jews to Yerushalayim, to the Beit HaMikdash. So when Achashverosh takes out the Kelim, Mikelim, Shonim, and those are seen as Klei HaMikdash, that's temporary. Next generation, they'll go back to Yerushalayim. So I don't know. Again, this is a complicated one because the causes of this chronology, in other words, what give Chazal this chronology, is not just a question of interpretation. It really starts with their source material. There's a lot more that goes into their calculations. They're also building on some nevuot at the end of Sefer Daniel, where we get time periods of 490 years broken up into different subtypes, and they're making sure that this all aligns. So they're working with a lot of different constraints to make the timeline. Again, as I said, I'm not going to step you through how they got to these years in a lot of detail. The most important point that I want to make is that, I put it at the top of this page, that chronology then gives rise to interpretation. It's not just a question of chronology. That timeline also invites certain ways of reading Megillat Esther that a modern person can't read that way, because you're like, well, it's just not right historically, right? Like Esther is actually 50 years after the Jews returned to Yerushalayim. So, you know, it can't be paving the way for that return. But for Chazal, whose whole sense of the chronology is different, they also can read Esther very differently. So that allows for a number of like really interesting embellishments and interesting additions onto the story, which I think go in a few different directions. Here, I think I'm not going to spend too much time on these sources because I don't want to run out of time yet. I know we're going to run out of time soon. So just very briefly, I'll look at a couple of sources here and then we'll wrap up for today. So the Gemara in Megillah identifies our Mordechai with a Mordechai who is mentioned in the genealogies in Sefer Ezra and Sefer Nehemiah. Both in Ezra Perek Bet and Nehemiah Perek Zion, we get essentially the same list of people who come back. Just repeated with really, really minor details. Chazal, of course, were attuned to those minor discrepancies because they read incredibly carefully. So whereas most people are like, get to Nehemiah's eye and they're like, oh my God, I read this already. It was boring the first time. I'm not reading it again. Chazal were paying incredibly careful attention and notice, for example, that Mordechai is mentioned fifth in the list in Ezra Perek Bet, but sixth in the list in Nehemiah Perek Zion. That one extra name has been added to his pasuk, so they make something of that discrepancy. But the most important thing that I want to mention is simply that they identify Mordechai of Megillat Esther with the Mordechai who goes back to Yerushalayim in Sefer Ezra. That, of course, is weird, because if Mordechai goes back to Yerushalayim, what's he doing back in Shushan? Right? If he went to with the Jews, with Shesh Bazar and Zerubbabel to Yerushalayim when they were allowed to go back, then how does he wind up in Shushan in the days of Achashverosh? Well, that's tackled in another Midrash, in Midrash Panim Achirot. It's actually the one that it's the very first one in the collection, so it happened to be on the screen a few minutes ago, where we get parts of the story show up in a lot of different sources. Actually, the longest version of the story shows up in the Targum. There are two Targumim to Esther, which are not at all like Unkelus in being literal translations. They have massive Midrashic additions into them. If anyone has the Torah Chaim of Megillat Esther, edited by Katzen Ellenbogen, which is a fantastic publication of the Rishonim on Esther, and in the back he has the two Targumim on Esther in good editions. So it's a great place to look for them. But we got the part of the story here, a long story told in a number of sources of how Haman and Mordechai have actually known each other for a very, very long time. In one version of the story, they were both Persian generals off in India, being sent there by Achashverosh to lead the Persian army in conquering the East. In all versions of the story, Mordechai winds up saving Haman's life and thereby acquiring the rights to Haman's servitude, or at least indebtedness. And that's important for framing some other things that Chazal then say about the dynamics in the Megillah. But in this particular version of the story, you see here, Ba'u livnot beit hamikdash, va'amad aleihem Haman ha'rasha, hu safra Shimshai ben Haman, misham yarad prosbotim kinegdo. Mordechai yarad b'shloshi yibane beit hamikdash, or yivne beit hamikdash. Skip a little bit. Mordechai yarad b'shloshi yivne beit hamikdash b'yamav, v'Haman yarad b'shloshi yibatel binyan beit hamikdash. So in this midrash, Haman and Mordechai know each other from a long time ago. They had both been in Yerushalayim earlier. Haman had gone to prevent the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, and Mordechai had gone to assist with the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. And they see a connection to this in Sefer Ezra, Perek Dalid, where we get the line that Malchut Achashverosh, B'tchilat Malchuto, Katvu Sitna al Yeshvei Yehuda B'Yerushalayim. So that's associated with Haman here. But when you piece these things together, you get a very long story that Chazal start to spin, where Mordechai, remember, he had gone to Yerushalayim. It says so in the beginning of Ezra. Mordechai had gone to Yerushalayim, but it wasn't only Mordechai. It was Mordechai and Haman. They had gone as adversaries to Yerushalayim, Mordechai to help with the Binyan Beit HaMikdash, Haman to prevent the Binyan Beit HaMikdash. This, of course, presents Haman as an anti-Semite from the beginning, right? So it's not just an accident that he bumped into Mordechai, was angry at him, and decided to kill all the Jews. He hated the Jews from the beginning. He had been working for decades to prevent the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. It presents the animosity between Mordechai and Haman as, first of all, deep-rooted and long-lasting, and also not personal at all. But this is not because Mordechai and Haman don't like each other. It's because Mordechai is working on behalf of the Jews, and Haman is working to foil the Jews' initiatives, again, for decades already. And then, in some of the versions of the story, and this is told in different ways, but Mordechai comes back to Shushan to advocate again to allow for the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, and Haman, of course, has to come back to advocate against it. So all of these things are, first of all, allowed by the chronology we just talked about, right? So, of course, none of this is going to make sense if you assume the Beit HaMikdash is already standing when Esther takes place. It's only because Chazal assumed that the Beit HaMikdash is not standing. But once you assume that, all of these really interesting interpretive possibilities emerge as to why Mordechai may have been in Yerushalayim earlier, what his earlier connection with Haman was, and so on, that, of course, put the put the story in a vastly different light once these things are said as introductory passages. So they're never actually said as introduction in the formal sense, not like in the Greek edition where you just add something on in the beginning. But if you say like, oh, you have to know the prequel, right? You have to know what happened before this about Haman and Mordechai. But then that puts the relationship between Haman and Mordechai in Paragimel, for example, in a very different light. Right? Why is Mordechai upset at Haman? Not because he won't get up and bow. Come on, that's silliness. He's not a trivial kind of person with thin skin. He hates Mordechai. They've been fighting for 30 years already, all about Jewish sovereignty and religious self-determination. In other words, whether the Jews should have a Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, this has been their causa bella for decades. So these are ways in which Chazal paint the story very differently by seeing it as connected to other parts of Tanakh. So I want to just, since we're going to run out of time in a second, I just want to go back to one sense of the passage I started with from Halbertal, that the moment that a book becomes a part of the scriptural canon, the exegete is obligated to make it consistent with the rest of scriptures. Now, what we've seen in the last couple of sources is that that's not just a question of ideology, like Esther shouldn't be different from the rest of Tanakh. But it's also that the book of Esther should be integrated narratively into the rest of Tanakh. In other words, the story in Ezra of people returning in Perek Bet, the story in Ezra of people writing a letter to Ahasuerus protesting construction in Yerushalayim, that's going to be seen as the other half of the story of Megillat Esther. We have to put these things together. And by doing that, I'm making a number of assumptions about characters being the same and the same people being in different places, in different books and so on. You wind up with a much richer and bigger story that in turn makes all of the little stories be seen in a different light than they do on their own. So it's not just a story of Esther that's sort of isolated on its own here. Now it's a story of Esther that's integrated into the grand narrative of the construction of the Beit HaMikdash that we were reading in Sefer Ezra, the genealogies in Sefer Nehemiah, and so on. Okay, so let me open the chat and we're going to have to wrap this up for today, even though we have a lot more to do in Chazal. Okay, let me see. Yeah, these are good questions. Mordechai has complained has a false note. The nuclear settlement. Okay, yeah, good point, Ruth. We will return to that in a lot of ways over the next couple of weeks.
If you don't
That's
mind
really
reading,
interesting point, Epi. They also read their own. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just saying, if you could read the chat for people who listen, who aren't in the class, so they can hear this sort
yes.
of question.
Yes, okay, I'll read the, yes, absolutely. So Ruth made a really interesting point. Mordechai's complaint has a false note. Jews are not all in exile. There's a nucleus of settlement in the land of Israel now. Mordechai should be there, not in Babel. If all Jews were in exile, he has a leg to stand on. The God can retort, you should have made Aliyah. So I want to make the observation that of course, depends on chronology. But if, as I think you're right, that's true. And so your response is going to be something that we'll see explicitly in the coming weeks, that there will be readers who will say, I mean, this is not a tragedy for the Jews in Babel. Jews in Babel brought it upon themselves. Like, why are you in Babel? So, of course, that depends on recognizing the possibility of living in Israel and taking it as a given that they should have been in Israel, right? Not only as possible, that it obviously would have been preferable. So you can imagine what kind of readers would turn around and say that to Mordechai and Esther. Satmar, for example, would not. Right? But it's a great point, Ruth, and good formulation. Now, Epi pointed a really interesting point. Chazal did not only have the historical sources in Tanakh, they also read history into their own lives, into the Jewish story. I think, broadly speaking, that's true. But of course, they're not going to use their own lives as sources for the years of the Persian period, for example. So that's really all I meant right now, was that they were using Tanakh as their sole source for reconstructing the history of 500-600 years ago. But certainly you're right that they tell other things about history. And I hope that next week we'll actually see a little bit of that, at least briefly. Okay, so Sal asked a really good question that we have the Talmud and the Targumim. There isn't an answer to the which came first, the Talmud or Targumim, as a general question. Some of the Targumim we have are really quite early. Targumim like Unklus and Targum Yonatan and Navi are really possibly significantly earlier than the Mishnah. But the Agadic Targumim, including the two Targumim on Esther, are probably contemporary with, maybe a little later than the Yerushalmi. So they're all from Eretz Yisrael, and they, or at least originally from Eretz Yisrael, and they're certainly contemporary with the latest of the Amoraim, and then maybe a little bit later than that. So they're operating in a different world than the Bavli and the Talmud Bavli, but it's all happening within a couple of centuries, let's say 5th, 6th, 7th centuries of the Common Era. Yeah, Bilshan. Okay. And Shpinza said, leaders, rabbis may want to be with their groups in exile like today. So I guess that's a partial defense of Mordechai's staying, assuming that he couldn't get everyone else to go. Maybe he has a need to stay, even if he would have wanted to be a Zionist. So that's a really interesting point. And we will have to leave it there. Okay, so next week we will continue with Chazal, and then we'll see that that sets the stage for a lot of modern questions as well. So we will transition to that next week, I hope. All right.
Okay.
Have a wonderful week.
Thank you very much. Okay, 28 minutes.
Thank you so much.
And Rachel Sharansky-Danziger will be continuing her series on the ins and outs of liberty. Today's topic, upending the world order. I don't know if she's talking current events or Shmot. She says Shmot chapter 7 to 10, upending the world order. That's at 11 a.m. as she continues.
Father Kalman, if I could interject, she's been writing very eloquently and insightfully about the current events.
Obviously, you know, of Russian descent, obviously. And
yes, she has a lot
I
know. To say.
I said that, of course. Yes, she writes beautifully and she teaches beautifully. So if you haven't heard her, I encourage you to come today. That's in 28 minutes still. Every week at Tuesday following Dr. Kohler, back to back, you know, I don't want to say you're the warm up back. That wouldn't be right. You warm up each other. Okay. And then we have triple header today. We're unlike baseball. We do triple headers. And then at 1 p.m., Alex Israel, 1 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. in Israel. Of course, Alex Israel continuing Eliyahu, Prophet of Fire. Those are our two upcoming classes today. And then tomorrow at, 2:30, Mark Shapiro interviewing Rabbi Oberlander from Hungary. He's also on the border of Ukraine. We're visited in Jewish history, talk about Jewish life in Hungary. That's tomorrow afternoon. And then 8 p.m., Dr. Sokolo continues his series on the putting together of Tanakh. Thursday morning, Thursday noon, Eastern time, Shuli Mishkin continues his series on archaeology. 8:30 p.m. our weekly Parsha Shir, this week given by Rav Shlomo Gemara, a vice principal at Chat here in Toronto. And then Friday morning, 9 a.m. my Shir on the Sidur. So there are lots of Shirim to invite your friends to attend. Invite one, invite many. Come to the Shirim, please. And Dr. Kohler, thank you very much. And we look forward to continuing next week. Lots to do. Megillat Esther is a beautiful, I will say, that this week I picked up a new book to put in my library that I don't have so much room for, but Bavakasha. So Rabbi, a doctor, I don't know if you see, this is Aaron Kohler's book, Esther and Ancient Jewish Thought. So published by Cambridge University. So anyways, Cambridge Press. So we look forward to seeing you. We will keep the station on. So you can just stay here, unmute yourself, turn off your video. Most of you have your video off anyway, and then come back at 11 a.m. Okay, that's now in 26 minutes. So that was 2 minutes of announcements. Not bad, not bad. Usually the president and shul Shabbos morning makes them longer than that. So we do a little quicker. Okay, everybody, be well. Thank you very much. And you have lots of time to invite your friends. That's okay. Bye-bye.